Oh, look, the September unemployment report came out today. We will talk about that. Also, an unexpected angle on oil. And then cows. Canadian cows. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 5th day of October, 2018. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, lots of news today. We get it. But we are going to keep our eye on the economic ball. And the ball on this Friday was the September unemployment report. It was a good 134,000 new jobs, a nearly 50-year low on the unemployment rate, down to 3.7%. So we will start there and then venture further or perhaps farther afield. I never get them right. Catherine Rampell writes for The Washington Post. Neela Richardson is with Edward Jones. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Neela, it's jobs day. You're on. That means we're going to talk about wages. I want to point out that the jobs report was actually good. A little bit of a miss on the number of jobs, but people should be happy with it. Wages, however, are another thing entirely still. And again.
You know what? It really didn't matter what the jobs number was going to be. Markets were looking past that, right at wages. Wages were the focal point. And what we saw is that there was some sustained growth in wages. It was a little bit lower than last month, but some growth at 2.8%. It was enough growth to spark some concern in the market that this would spill over to consumer prices and prompt inflation and cause the Fed to tighten more aggressively than previously anticipated. So even that small pickup in growth was enough to concern the markets about inflation and rising rates. And we saw that play out in the stock market.
Catherine, let me pivot a little bit to trade and the president and where we stand. It is somehow amazing to me that it was only 5 days ago that we reached agreement on the new NAFTA. China is still out there. We have still a president who's not enamored with multilateral institutions. Yet we have a dynamic and strong and growing economy in the United States. Where do we stand on how things might play out?
I think it's pretty striking that we've basically spent the last year and a half alienating our friends, punishing farmers and manufacturers with tariffs and counter tariffs, and breaking apart the hard-won alliance that we had built to try to isolate China. And we ended up in more or less the same position that we were in before, which is NAFTA is still more or less in place, plus elements of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Trump had broken up or had pulled us out of last year. So, you know, I think the best thing you can say about this deal is that it could have been a lot worse. And markets clearly breathed a sigh of relief that the existing structure is kind of still there, that Trump did not break globalization despite his rhetoric suggesting that he had hoped to do so.
That's a good line, did not break globalization. Neela, put on your actual certified economist hat, which I should point out you are, and pull it back for me to a 35-ish thousand foot level and talk about what Catherine was talking about, this idea that we are now distinctly trying to go it alone in this global economy politics here being tenuous at best in terms of being able to get things done and where things play out now for the remaining 2 years of the president's term and perhaps four.
It's a bumpy road ahead. What this negotiation process taught us is that even something that should have been a sure thing, which is to continue on with NAFTA, which is essentially what happened, took a way longer with much more drama than probably necessary. And that's with the North American trade agreement, right? Now, let's look at something much more complicated that really speaks to the future of China and the development of the emerging world. We're in a negotiation in which we do have some solid reasons for pushing forward, but China also has some solid reasons for pushing back. And so as much as markets cheered the continuation of NAFTA or some kind of new named rose that smells as sweet, it's hard to translate a slow win in North America with a long process with the rest of the world, yeah. where China is an emerging leader and has a growing power in terms of their economic strength and the supply chains in which they sit right in the middle of. Yeah.
You two have some great lines today. Slow win, that's a great line. Okay, look, let me turn to the news of the day because we have to acknowledge it. Susan Collins declaring that she is, in fact, Senator from Maine, that she is, in fact, going to vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh. Joe Manchin doing the same thing. He will likely be on the Supreme Court come, Monday or Tuesday. I want to talk for a second, Catherine, about how broken the politics are in Washington and what that will mean for anybody's economic agenda, because there are things that have to get done, right? There are budgets that have to get done. There are social programs and farm bills, and all of that stuff still has to be done. 30 seconds to you and then to Neela. Where do things stand?
I think the status quo is very troubling. It's not only the regularly scheduled types of tasks that you mentioned, like getting budgets through, for example, that Congress has to manage, and the presidency as well, the executive branch as well. At some point, there will be a crisis. And the fact that we have so much political dysfunction suggests that we are in store for a lot of policy dysfunction. And when I have talked with people who were around for the last crisis 10 years ago, that's the number one thing that they said that keeps them up at night, that basically what's going to happen when we actually need everyone to work together and come to policy conclusions that may not be popular ones.
Neela, to you quickly, please.
Sure. And I just want to add on to what Catherine, I think, just said, which was, this is occurring, the political dysfunction, if you want to call it that. It's occurring at a time where we have really strong economic health, a lot of wealth being created in the economy. Investors are benefiting. We're seeing some wage growth. What happens when the economy naturally turns, as is part of a natural business cycle? Well, that's when the government plays a role. And what we need at that point is a government that functions together for the betterment of the economy. And hopefully by then we'll get it.
Neela Richardson at Edward Jones, Catherine Rampell at The Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks,
Kai.
Have a nice weekend. One more quick thing about the state of economic play right now, especially in light of the jobs numbers this morning, which, as you've heard, put unemployment in this economy at a level not seen since 1969. You roll that in with what's been going in this week in the bond market. Sabrina and I talked about that yesterday. Good economic numbers pushing yields, that is, interest rates higher. And it gets me to this, a comment from Chris Lowe. He's the chief economist at FTN Financial. He's also a Friday regular on the Marketplace Morning Report, which in most markets was preempted this morning for, shall we say, other news. Anyway, Chris pointed out to David Brancaccio this morning that Chris works on a bond trading floor and that people in the bond markets, they've got long, long memories.
People are really nervous. 1969 is remembered as the beginning of the big mistake that led to 1970s inflation. And particularly the older guys out there, they don't think this is at all amusing. But, what I like to remind them is the other thing that happened in the 70s is that oil increased in price from $3 to $40. It would be the equivalent of oil costing $400 a barrel in 10 years. That might be a little inflationary, too.
Yeah, just a bit. West Texas Intermediate, by the way, $74.34 a barrel today. That was Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial, from the Marketplace Morning Report this morning. I thought that one deserved to be heard. To the broader point that Chris was making of stocks and bonds and rates, oh my, not such a great day on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the line items in that jobs data that Neela and Catherine and I were talking about is the percentage of the workforce in this country that has more than one job. 4.9% of people in September is the number. And it's been pretty steady over the past decade or so, even as the actual unemployment rate has been declining. So we sent Marketplace's Mariel Segarra off this morning with this assignment. Who are the people in this economy who have more than one job, and what's it like for them?
Matthew Spencer has a whole bunch of jobs.
I'm a personal trainer, a masseuse, a coach, therapist, and a full-time dad.
He's a single dad, lives in California.
Los Angeles, it's hard to have just one income and one job stream that pays enough to live.
Spencer is one of many people who work multiple jobs because they can't afford not to. Jody Jordan lives in New Orleans. She opened a CrossFit gym a few years ago. but it only brings in about 25 grand a year.
Following your dream doesn't always mean being able to pay your bills.
So she also works for a big consulting firm. Like Spencer, she has kids, two of them.
It never stops. I get up at 4 a.m. every morning, and I am working in some capacity until 7 or 8 o'clock at night.
That kind of stress can catch up to you. Tyler Gengel lives in a Detroit suburb, works three jobs, one at Frito-Lay and two doing security at pro sports events. Sometimes he forgets where he's supposed to be.
You'll get a call from your boss at 11 in the afternoon. Hey, Tyler, where are you? I'm sorry, I worked two doubles yesterday. I'm sorry. All right, we'll get in here.
Not everyone works a second job out of necessity. Ariel Castillo lives in Queens. She's a content producer for the English soccer team, Manchester City, and she teaches yoga on the side. She started the yoga gig while she was at her last full-time job, which was demanding and stressful.
I always had this other thing that I could sort of rely on, or that at least would make me fulfilled in the other hours of the day.
She's still teaching yoga because she loves it. Plus, in New York, the extra income doesn't hurt. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
All right, as promised, here comes the unexpected angle on oil. Most of the time when we talk about energy and how much of it the world uses, we think transportation, right? Fuel, gas, all that stuff. Well, here's another one. Chemicals made from oil and gas. A report out today finds that petrochemical demand is rising to give us things like synthetic rubber, packaging, fertilizer, also detergents. And as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now from the Sustainability Desk, in the long run, chemicals might be a bigger driver of world oil demand than actual driving.
Every day, the world uses 99 million barrels of oil. That's according to the International Energy Agency. The IEA says another 7 million per day will be demanded by petrochemical users within 30 years. We're talking about fertilizer, tires, pharmaceuticals. But the world's biggest petrochemical addiction rhymes with elastics. Here's IEA analyst Araceli Fernandez.
From 1970 even, the growth of plastics and the demand for plastics has grown much faster.
Faster even than other bulk materials, stuff for construction and infrastructure.
Such as cement or aluminum or steel as well.
Over the past generation, she says plastics use has been a rich country story, but going forward, it's emerging economies. Simply put, it's hard to find an alternative when it comes to performance and price. Analyst Mark Aramo at IHS Markit says metal, glass, and paper underperform compared to plastic in a lot of contexts.
Milk jugs, just containers for beverages, or some of your more sophisticated applications that we may be using under the hood of a car.
Until now, demand for petroleum was mostly for transport, driving, flying, shipping. But in the next few decades, the IEA's Fernandez sees a scenario where that use peaks because of shared vehicles, electric cars, etc. However, she sees no peak demand for chemicals.
In that type of scenario, petrochemicals would be the only oil demand segment that would be positive in terms of growth from now to 2040, 2050.
There is, of course, the challenge of plastic disposal, which has led to bans or taxes on plastic straws and bags and recycling. But the IEA thinks those efforts will be far outweighed by new plastic consumption around the world. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Sleep, it stands to reason, is big business. I mean, everybody's got to sleep, right? And the mattress industry has been getting a little bit, well, shall we say, restless lately. There have been bankruptcies and online disruptions as well. From WESA Marketplace's Eric Barris has more on the fight over that small piece of real estate where we lay ourselves down at night.
I'm in the market for a new mattress, and when I started my research, I went where most people my age go, online. And it is overwhelming. There are hundreds of mattress startups out there. That's because
the cost to start an online mattress company is next to zero.
That's Jeffrey Gallick, a marketing professor at Carnegie Mellon University.
Few of the companies that are selling online actually manufacture their own mattresses. What they do is they find a mattress manufacturer somewhere overseas, they slap their branding and their logo on there, and then they promote the heck out of it as much as they can.
And it's working for them, says Charles Lindsay, business professor at the University of Buffalo. He says these startups now have about 12% of the nearly $15 billion retail mattress market. What these online companies offer is convenience.
The mattress is compressed and vacuum sealed. They ship it for free. Pretty easy peasy.
More often than not, it's younger shoppers buying mattresses online, says Ryan Trainer, president of the International Sleep Products Association. On average, people replace a mattress every 10 years. For 19 to 35-year-olds, it's more like every 6 years. Trainer says that's because
younger consumers have been kind of conditioned to replace their phone after a couple of years, regardless of whether the phone is still functional or not. They're wanting to get the latest and greatest bells and whistles with their product. And I think they're carrying that over to other durable goods, such as mattresses.
Not quite the case for me. My mattress is more than a decade old, and all the online browsing isn't enough. I'm still planning on going to a few stores. And that, too, is on trend. Some of the bigger mattress online startups are moving into brick-and-mortar stores, so customers can try them out the old-fashioned way, just as I plan to do, by lying down. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think that was a necessary concession that we made, and I'm happy that we did.
The trade-offs of a trade deal, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 180 on this Friday, 0.2%, closed at 26,447. The NASDAQ off 91 points, 1 1/10, 77.88. The S&P 500 slipped 16 points, about 0.5%, 28.85. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow essentially flat, the NASDAQ down 3.2%, S&P 500 off 0.9%. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, Kai, has been on the rise all week, as we've been telling you. Monday closed at 3.08%, today 3.23%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
And we are back with our podcast, Make Me Smart, asking people the question that never fails to get a great answer.
I would say eventually.
What is something that you thought you knew and then later found out you were wrong about? Take a moment, take a breath, think about it.
It's going to take a while.
Tell us your answers.
Check us out at makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're going to dip back into the labor market here for a little bit because, you know, jobs and consumer spending and thus overall economic growth, all of that. But we are going to dip back in now through the immigration code. Back in April of last year, President Trump signed an executive order called Buy American and Hire American, in which he obliged the federal government to, among other things, and this is a quote, rigorously enforce and administer the laws governing entry into the United States of workers from abroad. Over the past year and a half, that's meant a bunch of changes to immigration policy, some of them big, some of them less big. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the story.
Peter Lin is a 28-year-old management consultant with 2 master's degrees. We're not using Lin's real name or identifying his employer. It could jeopardize his job. He wants to grow in his career. He wants to move on, but he feels trapped.
It's really frustrating me because it's really hard for me to transfer the job.
Lin emigrated from China. He has a skilled worker H-1B visa. The problem is that in order to switch jobs, he has to transfer his visa from one employer to another. That process, under the Trump administration, now takes 6 months or longer. It used to take a couple weeks. Even though he's perfectly qualified, potential employers are telling him, forget it. They don't want to wait 6 months.
It's just really, like, stressful because my future career is limited by the visa.
Lin is one of many people, many of them educated, skilled people, whose lives have essentially been put on hold by a pile of changes to immigration policies. In Lin's case, the administration ended expedited processing for urgent applications. That's why it now takes months where it used to take days. They're taking so long, in fact, that temporary work authorizations, like those given to recent graduates, are running out. Justin Storch is with the Society for Human Resources Management.
People might not be able to start their jobs or continue. A lot of people are really looking at a situation where employers are going to have to be taking people off of payroll potentially.
It's also become more difficult to extend an H-1B work visa. Immigration officials have become more strict. New rules make it easier for them to reject applications. In the last quarter of 2017, there was a 70% increase in applications held up by further questioning by immigration. Denials increased 41%. Nell Barker is a Chicago-based immigration attorney who's seen a lot of clients affected by the new policies.
There's this wall being built to restrict legal immigration and make it as hard as possible as a deterrent for companies and people to use the process that exists.
Justin Storch with the Society for Human Resources Management says this is not the best time to be making work visas more difficult.
There's more open jobs right now than Americans looking for jobs. So employers are really looking for the talent they need wherever they're from. So visas, immigration is obviously required in that situation in many cases.
U.S. immigration officials declined to be interviewed for this story, but said in a press release back in August that they were committed to protecting wages and working conditions. They also said the total number of visas granted met the limit of 85,000 set by Congress.
They are enforcing the law as it is.
Sarah Blackwell heads advocacy group Protect U.S. Workers. She sees the policy changes as a way to fight abuses of the work visa system.
American tech workers are being forced to train these foreigners who are coming in, and then they lose their job.
Firms with more than 15% foreign workers do tend to pay substantially less than other firms, according to the Migration Policy Institute.
That's definitely a good issue to focus on. The H-1B visa was, of course, never intended to replace U.S. workers.
Sarah Pierce is a policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute.
But it might not be the best way to go about it. In all of these policy changes, the Trump administration is making life more difficult, not only for foreign consultant companies that might be replacing U.S. workers, but they're also making it more difficult for legitimate employers that are just trying to hire the best and the brightest.
The changes to immigration policy rolled out over the past year and a half are not the end of what is an evolving set of rules. The administration is expected to announce additional changes next year. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Of the many sticking points in the recently settled negotiations over the new NAFTA deal, the Canadian-American dairy economy was by far the stickiest. American producers of milk and cheese, also the president of the United States, complained mightily about Canada's very tightly controlled dairy industry. And while the new deal does open the door to some more American cheese and milk headed north, small milk and cheese producers in Quebec, home to half of all Canadian dairy, by the way, well, they are not thrilled. Emma Jacobs has more on that from Montreal.
Baskets of apples and fall vegetables are stacked high in the Jean Talon market in Montreal. Farmers from around the region have stands in the open air, while small, permanent shops sell a variety of local and international groceries. On a recent afternoon, shoppers who've been following the NAFTA renegotiations were still weighing the new agreement. It was very disappointing, says Isabelle Croteau, whose cousin is a dairy farmer. She says there's a risk that allowing more lower-cost American milk into the market will, quote, destroy all these little Quebecois farms, which are local producers that we should encourage. Shopper Simon Miville-Deschenes lives just outside Montreal. He says the health of the Quebec dairy industry is important and is willing to pay the higher prices that come from Canada's system to protect milk and cheese producers. But he thinks the compromise on dairy was a fair price to salvage an agreement with Canada's largest trading partner.
I think that was a necessary concession that we made, and I'm happy that we did. To be able to get some of the other aspects of the deal that we were adamant in retaining.
Canadian economists say it's not clear yet what the new agreement will mean for dairy prices, but it's probably bad news for small farmers, who will be required to produce less. At Jean Talon Market, cheesemaker Hugh Ouellette is worried. He says Quebec's dairy industry feels under attack from all sides, with the NAFTA replacement as just another blow. Under recent trade pacts with Asian and European countries, Canada agreed to open its market to more of their dairy products. Ouellette is stopping by a cheese shop that carries his products, owned by Véronique Comin. Comin says she hasn't seen much impact from those other deals so far. The European cheese she carries isn't that much cheaper than before Canada's trade pact with the European Union. And she finds shoppers at her store are still more interested in local varieties and willing to pay a premium for them. That's true of Laura Ruggieri, originally from New York City, but who's lived in Montreal for 9 years. She and her Canadian husband had already shifted their buying habits in response to this summer's trade war with the U.S.
Because of that, we have been buying more local dairy from small producers, just to show our support for the local dairy industry here.
The NAFTA replacement is still not yet final. The agreement requires action in Canada's Parliament, Mexico's Congress, and the U.S. Congress before it can take effect. In Montreal, I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the latest in the recent string of perhaps curious rebranding decisions. Weight Watchers is now WW. Dunkin' Donuts, as we told you the other day, is now just Dunkin' to emphasize their coffee-first mindset. That's true. That's what they said. Now comes a 150-year-old brand known the world over, but henceforth to be known as the Tabernacle Choir at Temple Square. Leadership of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints have decided Mormon just doesn't work anymore. All right, let's put another one in the books, huh? Dow Industrial's off 180 today, 2/3%. NASDAQ down 91 points, 1/10%. S&P 500 off 16, that's about 0.5%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.